Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice-weekly podcast for people who do the fine art with needle and thread. And our guest this week is Anne Marie Anderson Mays of Beautiful Stitches in Perth, Australia. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm going to be okay good. Here. Yes. So I've been kind of on an Australian kick here lately. This is fantastic. Never thought much about time zones in Australia. Have learned that you have three of them. And
we do.
Yes. So.
Yeah, we're a much bigger country than some people think.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I live in the remotest city in Australia. So for me to get to a decent sized city takes another 2 or 3 hours flight to get from Perth to anywhere else. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. See, I'm learning geography right along with needlework. This is fantastic.
You are. Yeah. Yeah.
So we have Beautiful Stitches. Now, I'll tell you how I encountered you.
I'd love to know this story.
Yes. I have you on Feedly, my news feed, and so that I pick up your blog posts.
Aha.
Yes. And you don't do that very often, or it's been a while.
It's been a while.
Yeah. So the one that popped up the other day was that you teach embroidery, but you really teach confidence.
Correct. Yeah.
And I said, wait a minute, I got to read this. And so then I read the blog post, and then now I have to talk to you. So.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. Because I thought that was so interesting. And actually, now a couple of weeks ago, I talked about that in a midweek show with Debbie Rowley, a needlepoint designer here in the States.
Yep, and I listened to that, and I heard that too. Oh. After I'd written my blog post, I listened to the conversation with Debbie, and I went, oh, yeah, see, there's other people who think the way I do.
Well, see, that was based on, so I wanted to talk to you about that because I thought that was really insightful, number one, and then number two, something that had never crossed my mind. And Debbie found the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. You know, it's something I feel quite strongly about, that embroidery is something that anybody can do if they want to, because it's basically, at its very fundamental level, it's needle up, needle down. And then there's just a myriad of options that you can take from there. I had been thinking about what my teaching load would look like this year and... in terms of, you know, how I might advertise some of the different things that I do. And it occurred to me that I really needed to put into writing what my teaching philosophy was. And that's what it is. I don't believe that at its most fundamental level that I teach embroidery. I teach people to be confident because there are a million wonderful resources available to us via this incredible thing called the internet. So people can get access to the technical detail fairly easily in lots and lots of different formats and varieties and just about any permutation you can think of. But what the internet can't provide is somebody who says to you, no, you can do this, and just give it a go. And don't worry if you make a mistake the first time, because the first time may well be a mistake and then the next time it'll work. Or what was a mistake may turn out to be a new stitch which is fascinating and wonderful in its own right. And so that's that. I see my role as a facilitator and a builder of confidence. And I'm lucky to have taught in different kinds of environments. So sometimes I'm teaching quite short term, and sometimes I'm teaching over, you know, on a weekly basis. And I've got a class that I've been teaching for 4 years, and I've had women come in and out of that group who arrive believing that they're not creative, that this is too hard and they can't do it. And for me, the joy is seeing them after about 6 months coming into me and saying, oh, I've seen this picture and I'd really like to stitch it. And I say, well, let's go for it. How are we going to do it? What colours are you going to use? What fabric are you going to use? And to see that confidence building them is just the most wonderful thing for me as a teacher. So that is why I do what I do. It's what drives everything for me.
And, you know, it what interests me as a male is that if you look at today's woman, you know, effectively running a household, in most cases raising kids, and in a lot of cases also working a full-time job, you would think lack of confidence would be the least of items on a list. Because if you can handle all that, what's the needle and thread?
Yeah, there's probably several aspects to that. Possibly one of the first ones is that many of the women that I teach are older than me. So I've just turned 50, and many of them are a good decade or maybe two decades older than me. And they grew up in an era where there was a very, very clear right and wrong. And so for them, there's almost an inbuilt fear of whether they're doing it right or not. And that's a programming that's been in their background for quite a while. And so often the first thing you've got to do is get rid of that. You know, there is no such thing as right or wrong. This is art. This is you developing your own creative voice. So there is no right way. There is a way to do a stitch. You might come up with a different way to do a stitch. There may be an efficient way to perform a stitch, or there might be something that feels more comfortable to you, but there's no right or wrong. And I think that's one of the first things to build confidence. I guess the other thing is that and I can certainly speak for myself here, I grew up thinking that I wasn't creative. I did a TED talk on this a few years ago, or a TEDx talk at our local university here. And the whole idea that I wasn't creative was very strongly in my makeup. I could do other people's patterns, but I didn't believe I could create my own. And that meant that I wasn't creative. I was just a pattern follower. And I can track that back to an experience that I had where I was stitching cross-stitch bookmarks for all my teachers. This is about year 10, so I'm about 15 perhaps. And I gave one to my art teacher, and she looked at it and she said, "Oh, that's lovely." And she turned it over and she looked at the back, and then she turned it over and she looked at the front. She said, "Oh, you've done this wrong."
Oh, my.
And well, the thing is that I hadn't done my crosses in all the same direction. And so because I was a really strong academic student, I could do maths right. I could do physics right. You know, I could do chemistry right. So in my mind, that meant that I couldn't do art because I was doing it wrong. Do you know what I mean? And so
still, as a former teacher, I would never say that to a kid.
I don't think it was intentional, but because in my mind there was a very clear, I'm really good at these things that I get right. So because I'm doing this wrong, I'm clearly not creative. So that was the message in my head, and that's probably a completely warped interpretation on my part, but that was the message in my head. I carried that then for about, I'm going to say about 20 years. And what it took for me was actually then I did a year of finishing. I was a member of the Embroiderers Guild in Victoria, in Melbourne, and I did a year of finishing where all those cross-stitch projects that I had been doing over the years that had never been finished, in case I did the last bit wrong. Do you know what I mean? It was that last little bit, in case I did that last bit wrong. So they all these projects that were sitting there that were, I don't know, 70, 80% done, and in the end, I just had to – this lovely article came through in our magazine, do a year of finishing. So I did the year of finishing, and my husband was very impressed. I didn't buy anything for my stash for an entire 12 months.
That's all he cared about right there.
But it was just the most liberating experience to realize that it didn't matter whether it was right or wrong. Just finish it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the creative confidence gradually started to build. You know, confidence in women is a is a huge topic. Another one of my experiences in my background is that I ran a Women in Science and Engineering project for a while, and I came to understand that confidence in girls is a really big deal, and it's a deeply seated in our culture. So yes, it's really important that women find something in their life that helps them to build confidence. I think the thing I really like about what I do, especially with the women that I spend more time with, is that sometimes you'll see that the confidence that they might start building in the embroidery class and creatively, they then take into other parts of their life. And I love that. You know, that's to me.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's just such a lovely feeling to see that confidence builds and grows in other ways. I think that's very cool.
Right. And to know you were part of, well, that's as a former teacher, former teacher, that's the, you know, nothing else matters until you see those kinds of things. And then,
it's pretty special.
The kid who comes back 5 years later, you know, thank you for that moment because that turned me. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yep. Well, that's another thing is that I teach after school classes for children. And so I had a group of about 16 or 17 last year that I had for, I think, 9 weeks. So we did almost 2 hours after school once a week. And they came in, you know, barely able to thread a needle and all that sort of thing. And then by the end of the last project that I had them do was a piece of hoop art where they were completely free to put whatever design they wanted into that hoop. And I love teaching children because they don't have any limits on what they think can go into this space. So they don't worry about that. They just do it. But again, to see children who come in and I don't think I can do this or I won't be very good. And by the end of it, to have them take away a piece of hoop art that was their design, that they'd chosen everything, what it looked like, what colours it was, what stitches they were going to use. That's lovely. I think that they can take that away. And hopefully I might actually get to teach the same group of kids this year and we can build on those skills, which would be really, really cool.
Even better. Yeah. Yes.
Even better.
Yeah. That's kind of a sad thing that, it permeates, needlework everywhere, male and female, is that you're doing it wrong thing.
I know.
And you know, the needlework police, whatever, whether it's embroidery or needlepoint or whatever, but you're doing it wrong. And I just wonder through the years, how many people have been turned off because of that, who would have been enthusiastic, would have had it, you know, a great deal of fun and some even become very good designers, but, okay, never mind. I'm out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I totally agree. And hopefully, you know, the more I listen to teachers all around places that I go to, I think we are turning that around. And I think there's so many people in the embroidery world now who really advocate quite strongly for the absence of the embroidery police and to really embrace this as an art form. And I see that in the guilds that I have contact with as well. It used to be a very strong part of the guild process, I think. And don't get me wrong, there's a really important place for good technique and technique that underlines really, actually confident stitching. If you know that your stitching's not going to come undone, for instance, then knowing how to secure your thread so that technique is strong and means that your work is going to last is important. But there's an important place for that process and technique, but not at the expense of killing people's confidence.
Right.
So build their confidence first, and then you can share with them. Actually, if you secure your thread in this way, then it will never come undone, and you can be more confident with that. Mm-hmm. That's my attitude.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that is so true because the really top flight stitchers with a precise tension and all the, you know, everything lays perfectly and all that. Yeah, there's that, but there's it's that way in any hobby or any sport. There's also a massive body of people who just want to enjoy it.
And
if their tension isn't perfect from corner to corner and top to bottom, it just doesn't matter to them. They just enjoy doing it. And they should never be stopped from that.
No, exactly right. Exactly right. And we need to, we have a bit of a joke with my group that we all need to learn to sometimes step back a couple of paces. So don't look at it underneath your glasses.
Yes, there's step that too, back, isn't there?
Look at it from a distance and say, oh, you know, sure, you might know that there's one or two stitches that the thread might be slightly pulled or oh, I wish I'd done that cross in the other direction or whatever it is. But as soon as you take a couple of steps back, you don't see any of those little details, and the piece is beautiful. And that's why I call myself Beautiful Stitches, because I think they're all beautiful.
That's so true, because I pulled out a whole section the other night because it's on a reproduction sampler, and I just didn't like the way a couple of X's were lying, and I just wasn't happy with it. And I got it out, and then I got it all stitched back in, and I was happy with it. And then I realized I'm stitching one strand of silk on 40-count linen.
Yeah.
And I'm worried about under a 2-time magnifying glass, I'm worried about how it looks. And I just sat back and I thought, you're an idiot. You can't even see it from 6 inches away without the magnifier. Right. What are you doing?
Exactly.
So then I kind of smacked myself upside the head and moved on. Yep. But it's really easy to get caught up in that. Yes.
Yes. Yes, yes. It's funny. I teach a little section sometimes in my classes about crosses and whether they lie the right way, possibly because of the history with that year 10 teacher.
That's a childhood trauma for you. Yeah,
I know. So it's turned into this little thing that I do. But it's so funny to see stitchers who've had years and years of being told that their crosses all have to go in the same direction. And I'll say at the front of the class, well, I'm going to throw a spanner into that one and say, well, perhaps not. Perhaps they don't all have to go in the same direction. And we talk about the fact that the light is reflecting off the thread. And so the top of the cross is giving you a stitch direction. And perhaps in your piece, it might be quite nice to have the light coming off in different directions. So it might be quite nice to have a slightly different reflection happening by taking the crosses in different directions. And you might want almost like a subtle mottled because your crosses are not all going in the same direction. Or you might want a whole band going in one direction and a whole band going in another direction, and that will give you a different play of light again. But when I first say to a class of people who have got some experience stitches in them, well, you know, I don't know that your crosses all have to go the same way. I can see, almost see them holding onto their seats. It's like, oh dear, are you sure? But if you look at it as a brush stroke, if it's a paint stroke, then why not? Nobody says that the paint strokes all have to go in the same direction. So why do the tops of our crosses all have to go in the same direction?
Oh, now you got my wheel spinning here.
Ah, no.
Look at that, because think about that. You could add dimension and depth.
Yep.
Just absolutely. By doing that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And uh-oh. It's subtle, but it's beautiful. And I don't know whether you've seen. So I'm very lucky because my husband works in different parts of the world, and sometimes I get to see textiles that he or his colleagues have brought back from different parts of the world. And one of his colleagues a few years ago brought back a piece of cross stitch. It's called Akha, A-K-H-A. They're a tribe in Asia. And they do this cross stitch very, very, well, not as fine as what you're doing. I think it's over about 2x2 threads on a black ground that I counted and worked out was roughly about 28 count. They have white and then maybe half a dozen bright colours with it. But if you look up close, I imagine that the work is being done by a group of people. I don't think it's necessarily a single stitcher, but the crosses are not going the same way in any way. They're all quite just depends on how they were working and the rhythm of their stitching. So there is absolutely no uniformity to the top of those crosses, and it in no way detracts from the work. It's stunning. It's on my blog. So you have to go back a bit, but there's a picture of that. It's like a quilt cover, and some detailed photos of those individual little blocks. And it's just, it's exquisitely beautiful, and the crosses do not go the same way. So, yeah, there you go.
Oh, this is fun. I have to, now I'm going to have to sit down with some thread and a piece of cloth and just see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what I did. I actually I stitched some samples so that I could show people what I was trying to give them an idea of, just to show them exactly that. It's a painterly effect, yeah.
Yeah, because if you did a field with it going one way and another field with it going the other way, but then, like you said, rows or even every other cross, all of those would reflect a different light.
They do. That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
Okay, and it's all your fault. There we go. So is that where you started as a child, was cross stitch?
Yes. So I'm a classic. My mum taught me to stitch.
Okay.
I cannot remember a time when I didn't know how to do it. Does that sound weird? It's almost like it's been really my entire life. So mum tells me that I think she started us on huckaback, which is the I'm not sure exactly of my facts, but I think it's a Scandinavian needle weaving technique.
Oh yes, I've heard of that. Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a very easy technique, quite geometric still, but quite an easy technique to learn. And then very quickly we must have moved on to cross stitch, because I really can't remember a time when I didn't know how to do cross stitch. And we were doing, again, small little borders and Scandinavian style patterns or German style patterns. And I loved it. I just loved the geometry of it. But my background is in maths and physics, and so I think there's something in my brain that likes geometry and pattern and numbers and those sorts of things. And so I did cross-stitch for a very, very long time, because we travelled a lot and it was portable and I could take it anywhere with me. And I just really enjoyed the rhythm of stitching. At some point, my mum's an exquisitely beautiful embroiderer, and she does a lot of crewel and silk shading and that sort of stuff. So at some point, she did bring me into that side of things. I guess I must have been in my late 20s when I did some of that with mum. And then you're busy. I did a PhD and I had kids and all that sort of stuff. And in there, the easiest thing to keep picking up was
that'll affect your stitching. A PhD and kids, yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah. So I was still doing craft and whatever, but the easiest thing to pick up was cross stitch, because I know how to do it and I can, you know, it's a natural rhythm. So. But the thing that got me into canvas work was, this is whilst we were living in Melbourne, and I was part of the Embroiderers Guild there. There was a masterclass in canvas work embroidery that came up, and it was going to be once a month on a Sunday afternoon, so I could, you know, work it around small kids. And I looked at it and I went, oh, I'd really like to do that, because I knew that it was going to take that geometric style of stitching beyond the cross stitch.
Right.
And the rest is history, because I was hooked. You know, I was absolutely hooked. And, you know, we were talking earlier about creative confidence. I went into a group of, I think there were about 12 people in this group. And every time I stitched something, I would look at it and go, oh my goodness, I'm just not at the level of all the other women in this class. You know, some of them were, their stitch samples were exquisite and mine looked flat and uninteresting, and I thought my colour choices were off. But I was, I guess, lucky that I was so engaged by it, and the teacher was so fantastic and all the other students were fantastic, that I just kept going. You know, okay, we'll do the next piece and maybe the next piece will be better, and do the next piece and maybe the next piece will be better. Unfortunately, in one way, we had to move before I got to finish that class. So it was an 18-month class and I got to do 12 months of it. And then we moved back here to Perth. But it really didn't matter, because by then the door was open. I was completely hooked.
The disease had set in.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I live and dream it. You know, and I drive my family mad, because I'll look at something, oh, I wonder if I can stitch that.
Okay. I can see kids' eyes rolling right now. Yeah.
No, they do. But it's I was just so lucky that I got to do that course and find a path and have it open this creative door for me.
So you'd never done needlepoint, and you dove into a master class?
Yeah.
Now that's confidence right there. That's confidence.
or crazy, but I'm not sure. Hey. I mean, I knew about it, and I guess I'd probably done a few Smyrna crosses and maybe a bit of rice somewhere. And like I say, I had done a little bit of surface stitchery, crewel type stuff with mum. But I, yeah, I just knew that I liked the look of it, and I liked the idea of just being able to take that geometric stuff further. And I guess at the same time, I became quite obsessed with understanding the creative process because I didn't think I was creative.
Mm-hmm. Because your teacher told you weren't.
Yeah. Or I told myself that I wasn't. And so I think, since then, I've been fascinated to read books about creativity and to understand the creative process. And I think that's why I'm so certain that everybody can do it, because if I can do it, then I know that other people can experience the same change that I did. And once you break through that barrier of producing the first piece, which is genuinely your own design, however good or bad it is, as soon as you've got over that hump of having a go, making the mistakes, fixing the mistakes, doing it better, maybe choosing your colours better. But the more you do it, the more addictive it becomes. It's certainly addictive in my case, but also the more enjoyable that process comes. And so you just have to go through that initial doubt and I don't know whether I can do this and just do it anyway. You know, just have a go, take that idea that's in your head and do it, and then experience that, maybe that did work. Oh, now what will I, what could I do next? And that's for me was this real light bulb moment. And I was very grateful that the Canvas Work Masterclass, part of the structure of it was that every single piece we did, whether it was just a simple sampler or anything else, had to be our own design.
So oh, you no, were forced, no choice there. Oh, okay.
No choice. So you were forced to just jump in and do it. And there's something to be said for that. If you don't have a choice and you just have to do it anyway, then you do. You make a lot of mistakes and you find your way through it and then you start to reap the rewards.
And see, and there, you know, there's the role of the supportive teacher again. Giving you the tools to do the job and then
And I think because our lessons were only once a month, you had a lot of time in between to do the work and to explore the ideas. And I guess in my mind, because I already had an academic PhD behind me, to me it was just like, you know, this is like two of the best things in the world, because now I get to do almost like a PhD, but with my favorite hobby, you know. This life doesn't get any better than this. And I really enjoyed being able to dive deeply into a technique and look at historical pieces and that sort of stuff. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
So then you take that and now have found your way to designing and making a business out of it, teaching and.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the way the business came into shape was a little bit funny because, I guess once I had done the masterclass, I then really started to think, oh, I wonder if I could run a creative business. I wonder if I could do that. And I have no experience of small business at all. So, or at least I didn't then. So I had no
background. You do now.
Yeah, I had no background, no knowledge. And so that was a little bit alarming in itself. And my husband, bless his heart, was just – he wanted to be supportive, but it was like, oh, you know, what if you end up doing this and you end up hating your hobby because you have to do it all the time? And because he knows how important it is to me, he didn't mm-hmm. want me to lose the joy of what I do.
That's a legitimate concern too, because that happens, you know, hobbies all over the place. People decide they're going to make money off of them and then they ruin it and the fun's gone and then they're out altogether.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely a legitimate concern. And, you know, creative businesses, by and large, don't have a reputation for making a lot of money. So you don't really go into it for the money. For a while there, it was a case of, you know, is it possible? Can it be done? But I had a few friends around me, and also my two children, I have to say, were just delightful because they kept saying to me, I guess at this age, they were around 10 and 6 or something like that, Mum, if this is what you want to do, you should just do it. Right. Okay. And when your children say that to you, you go, that actually means a lot, because Because if I hadn't done it, then the message they would have got was that maybe you can't do it. And I really want my kids to have the message that, of course, you can do it. You know, mm-hmm. you can do whatever. So so the fact that they were behind me was lovely.
Yeah.
And then I had been talking to a few friends about how I was playing with this idea. And one of them said, you know, it's funny because in our generation, it's almost like sewing has skipped the generation. So this is it, mothers of children of the mothers of children at my daughter's school. But our kids really want to learn to sew. And I said, well, I can teach your kids how to sew. And that's how it started. Beautiful Stitches started by teaching children how to stitch after school. And so it didn't actually start out as a needlepoint business at all.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was by then developing my own designs, and it was, I guess, it's just a matter of putting them out there. The Embroiderers Guild in Western Australia here has been fantastically supportive, and they had me teaching, and I just kept – each year I sort of set myself a goal. So one year it was to get my head around social media, so and that meant that I could start sharing my work, and the more I shared my work, then the more interest I got, and slowly. I think actually the best piece of advice I had in the whole time of setting up my business was from my mum. Very wise lady, my mum. And she said, give yourself time. And so her timeline for me was, give yourself 5 years. So don't feel like you have to make this thing work in 6 months. And don't feel like you're going to know it all in 12 months. Give mm-hmm. yourself 5 years. And if in 5 years' time you're still really happy with it and it's growing and developing, then you've got something. And Beautiful Stitches started, what, 6.5 years ago now? And I think I probably knew after three that I had something that I was going to be able to run with for a while. But I think that was such great advice from Mum, to be able to just give yourself time to learn how to run a small business and give yourself time to learn how to be a designer on a bigger level rather than just having two or three, but a continuous stream of designs. Give yourself time to learn how to teach adults as opposed to teaching children, you know. So all of it was just a beautiful journey that I tried, because of Mum's words, not to put too much pressure on myself.
And yeah, lucky. She gave you that span to relax and just let it develop. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And have time to be a mum and look after kids and, you know, have a husband who travels away and be able to cover the base and all that sort of stuff. Because life goes on, you know, just because you run a creative business doesn't mean you haven't got all the other responsibilities of life. So, yeah. I'm very lucky. Very lucky that I've had such great people around me to help me make it happen.
Oh, that's terrific. So, and I'm really excited that you continue to have teach kids. That's great.
Yeah. Look, I really enjoy teaching children. Like I say, because they don't have some of the creative blinkers on that we seem to acquire as we drift into our teenage years, we start to really worry about that kind of thing. But mostly I teach primary school kids, so that's up to about age 11 or 12. And I love it. I think they're fantastic. They can be exhausting, don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah.
and when you've got, you know, 10 kids in a class and they're all struggling to thread their needle and all you seem to do for 3 hours straight is thread needles and undo knots. But I wouldn't want to do it all the time. So it's something that I call it sort of keep in contained boxes, if you like. So mm-hmm. I'll do either a school holiday program or an after-school program for a term or two. But then I do need a break. I'm not somebody who could do it all the time. But it is a pure joy to see them come out with a school. They might not use it for another 20 years. But I think if you've given them a little taste of it at this age, they may well come back to us in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, and keep the craft going.
Well, but isn't that, you know, to me, that with any hobby,
yep,
that's, I think, the most important part is just to put it in their heads.
That's exactly right.
And then, somewhere down the road, if it opportunity or things just click and they pick it up and go with it,
yeah,
you've done a great service for them. And
yes,
yeah, if yeah. they never do, you know, they were yeah. at least exposed to it.
That's right. And at the same time, if you sow that seed of creative confidence, then that's an important thing for them to have too, I think.
Yes, no doubt about that. So the one that stuck out for me is the Tresillian Art Center. How does that play a role in what you do?
Tresillian's been huge for me. Tresillian Art Center is a local community art center run by one of our local councils. It's in a beautiful old building. There's a small cafe in the building, and they run classes in art, craft, languages, those kinds of things. I think there's probably maybe two or three of us who teach crafty type stuff. There's a lot more teaching, watercolors or acrylics or mixed media type painting or life drawing, those sorts of things. And then there's a group of language teachers. But it's a really beautiful community environment where the way classes run is on a week-by-week basis. So I teach a regular class on a Friday morning and then more of a short course type format sometimes on a Wednesday morning where we might run a program for, say, 4 or 6 weeks, so just on a very specific topic. But the Friday class is ongoing. It's a lovely format because we come in and in the morning as we arrive, we order a coffee and maybe a piece of cake if we're feeling like a treat on that day. The order goes off to the coffee shop. We start stitching or doing whatever it is we're doing that day. And then somebody delivers the coffee to our classroom. Oh. And it's a really beautiful, creative environment. There are also practicing artists who rent studio space in that building. So there are practicing artists in the complex all the time. And they have ongoing pop-up exhibitions and that sort of stuff. And then once a year they have a student and tutor exhibition. So we have an exhibition of work that students and tutors have completed over the year. And that's a lovely way to showcase some of the creativity that's happening in that environment. So when they offered me the chance to start teaching a class 4 years ago, and that started with the school holiday stuff and then we added the adult classes to that, it really set the foundation for me to be able to explore some of these ideas about creativity and creative confidence and those kinds of things, because teaching short workshops is quite different to teaching these longer term programs. Fabulous center.
So with this long term thing, do you have an ongoing project or is it?
No, it's much looser than that.
Okay.
It's really just, it's a space for people who are keen on embroidery to come and join us. So some people might come in with very few skills, and so we'll start them off with learning basic stitches and doing some simple projects, which I would provide. Or they might have something that they've seen and they want to have a go at, so they can do that too. And then we really just let people choose their own project and run with it.
Oh, okay.
My role as a teacher then is to bring in resources. So, and that's been an amazing learning experience for me. So sometimes we might have a week session where we paint the canvas just so that people can experience getting out their paints and putting paint onto a piece of fabric or canvas and experiencing what it feels like and seeing what different effects they can get. We've done the same thing with watercolour pencils on canvas where you use your watercolour pencils and then you dab some water on and the colours start to bleed into each other. Layering fabric onto canvas. So there's a beautiful silk mesh product that I get from Treetop Colour Harmonies here, and it's just this exquisite silk mesh, very, very soft fabric, beautifully hand-dyed. And you can actually layer that over the top of a piece of fabric or your canvas and then stitch through the layers, and you can get these lovely effects by layering things up. We look at embellishments. We look at different stitch techniques. So I might teach them a bit of hardanger or a bit of surface stitchery or a bit of black work or whatever, just so that they get a taste, and then they take that back into whatever project that it is that they're working on. I have some people who prefer to work other people's kits. They might change the colours, so they'll work that sort of thing. I have other people who create everything from scratch, from the ground up. So, it just depends on what they want to do.
You're getting the full spectrum here. Wow.
Yeah. Well, and the other tutors laugh at me because I turn up So I live about 40 minutes drive away from the center. So I've got to pack up my car with all the gear in the morning, and I drive off and I unpack all my gear, and they always laugh at me and they say, "You've got so much stuff." I said, "Yes, but I want to make sure that each student has what they might need, because they're all working at different levels or on different types of projects, or they might want different types of threads, or they might want access to some, I don't know, some beads or some embellishments or some ribbon or whatever. And I want to be able to feed that creativity there and then." So, yeah, so it just goes into boxes, into the car, unpack it. Yeah, I get my workout on a Friday morning.
So basically, you're a moving needlework store then.
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, that's fun. But as a teacher, what a terrific time to have so much variety.
Absolutely. Oh. Yeah. And that's why if you follow me on Facebook, I'll sometimes, or Instagram, you'll see sometimes that I'll put in a post about what an amazing morning I've had with my Friday ladies again, because the dynamic, as people become more experienced and more knowledgeable, the dynamic becomes very cooperative, and I can throw an idea in and all of a sudden they're running in and taking it in a direction that I didn't know existed or hadn't thought of or whatever. And so it becomes this really beautiful cooperative inspiration, which I love. That's, again, it's why I do what I do.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun. That sounds like a day to look forward to every week.
It is. That's right.
Oh, good for you. And so this art center, then you have plenty of space and all the facilities you need, then, it sounds like, to just.
Yeah. Look, it's quite an old building. It's got a history. I think it's got a former history as a maternity hospital and all sorts of interesting things. But it's an older building, and we have a room that comfortably seats, say, 10 up to 10 people. That's more than enough space for us to do what we do. And everybody brings in their own stuff. Like, I turn up with my boxes and boxes, but they all come in dragging a suitcase or something, and they've all got their own stuff as well. It works beautifully. Very lucky to have access to that kind of thing.
The painters walk in with a brush. The needle workers walk in with a small truck. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, although I must admit that I have observed people doing mosaics who also seem to come trundling in with a whole heap of stuff.
Yeah, there's a world right there. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, but now this happens to me all the time. We're going to run out of time. I want to, sure. your couches and your chaise lounge, and folks who are listening, I'll put pictures up, and we'll put pictures on the FlossTube video so you can see these things. The most amazing three-dimensional needlework pieces. So tell about those. The first question I have is, how big are they?
So the chaise longue is probably about, maybe 18 centimeters long.
Okay, so 2.5 centimeters per inch. So we're talking 9-10 inches then.
No, less than that. Maybe 7 to 8 inches.
Okay,
that kind
all right.
of size. Yeah. The William Morris chair, which is probably one of the most popular in terms of patterns that I sell and teach, that's about 12 centimetres square on the base and, say, another 12 to 13 centimetres tall. So they're stitched on 24-count Congress. And the chaise longue, so we were talking earlier about this creative process and breaking through. I had this idea in my head that I wanted to do this chaise longue. I don't know why I've always had I don't even own a chaise longue, but I've always had a thing that there's such a beautiful shaped chair. So I had this idea in my head that I wondered if I could reproduce it. And I think one of the things where my background is in maths and physics, I was able to look at the shapes and break it down into something relatively simple. So actually, although it looks quite like a chaise longue, there's a long straight piece that forms like the spine of that chaise longue. So it goes from the short edge all the way along the long seat and then wraps around to form the curved back. And then all you have to do is stitch a back and a front, hold it all together with a base, and it's there. So when people come to a class to stitch it, they stitch five pieces. and then they put it together. And that sensation of the process of creativity, where the idea that was in my head emerged into this chaise longue, and that was my first experience of, oh my God, I did it. I did it. I did it. Whatever this thing was that it was in my head, it came out. And then of course I was hooked because I just wanted to do another one. And I was very fortunate to meet Michelle Hill. I don't know if you know Michelle. She's very famous for doing the William Morris applique quilts. She's based in Adelaide in South Australia, and I was fortunate to meet her through a mutual friend. And we had this lovely evening together, and I was showing her the work that I did. And she said to me, "Have you thought of doing anything inspired by William Morris?" And I went, "Well, actually, I haven't. But now that you've mentioned it to me, I will." And that's how the William Morris chair came about. It's actually a replica of, or my interpretation of a William Morris chair that's in the collection in the South Australian Art Gallery. And so I looked at the colours and the motifs and simplified it. And again, that piece has one long straight piece that forms the seat and the back. It has the two pieces that do the curvy arms, and then it has a long skinny piece that holds everything together at the bottom. So if you can deconstruct some of these things that look like quite complicated three-dimensional shapes into simple pieces, then all of a sudden it just becomes a matter of filling that shape with whatever needlepoint design or canvas work design that you want.
Yeah, and for people who say they've gotten bored with stitching, go to Anne-Marie's Etsy shop and buy one of these, because this will take boredom away from you in a heartbeat.
Oh, thank you, Gary. That's a lovely thing to say.
In the pictures, that's why I had to know how big they were, because they look like legitimate full-blown chairs. Yeah. And, it's very effective and really just fascinating. And that's what I started doing is, all right, how did she piece this together?
Yes.
Because I knew there was no way each of these panels was its own piece. There had to be some continuity here. And, I spent more than a few minutes trying to figure out how you did that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, so for instance, if you've done the William Morris chair, and actually I plan to do this myself, it's on my list of, do you have a long list of things that you want to stitch this year? I've always got more than I'm ever going to get through. But anyway, I have an idea that to take the shape of the William Morris chair, because the shape works so beautifully, if you've bought that pattern and you've got the shape, there's nothing to stop you completely redesigning the innards, if you like. So instead of working the flowers and the scrolls and the tendrils that are in my design, you could fill it with a different kind of pattern, because the shape is there. Once you know what the form of this chair looks like, you're then free to come up with a new design that fills that pattern with something completely different. So I really want to have a go at doing something which looks completely unlike a William Morris design, but using that same chair structure this year. That's on the list.
Yeah, what's the infrastructure there? Is there wood, or are you just using the stiffness of the...
No, it's card. So, sometimes it's card, and sometimes there's like the really stiff wadding that they put into bags. So mostly it's an acid-free mounting board that you cut and score to fold into the shape. The arms of the little William Morris chair, rather than putting card into them because that would have been too stiff, I put the bag wadding into it, and then that means it just has it's got a stiffness so that it holds its shape, but it has ever such a little bit of softness so that the arms can relax, if that makes sense, so they can relax out a little bit.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, I see that in the picture, yes.
Yep. So, if I run it as a class and I provide the kit, then I pre-cut all of those templates so that people don't have to be fiddling around with a Stanley knife themselves. If they buy the pattern off the Etsy store, then there's a pattern sheet in there and they can cut their own.
Okay.
But,
So by buying from the Etsy store, then you have everything you need to make this.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Fascinating thing.
Yeah. So the only thing is that you do have to stitch it on Congress. It really doesn't translate to, say, an 18-count canvas. Uh-huh. And I I don't think it would work as well in a linen, because Congress has that lovely property of almost looking like a linen, because it's got that nice even weave look to it, but it's got the size in it, so it's stiff, so it's got a bit of body.
Right.
And yes, you do end up in the process of constructing your chair, you do end up mashing that Congress cloth a little bit. In fact, I got the giggles when I was listening to you talking about ironing Congress the other day.
Oh.
or folding Congress. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, if they could see what I do to Congress as I, as I push it into shape, trying to make my chairs. But, so yes, you do have to manipulate it a little bit. So far I haven't had any problems. It still ends up looking pretty good. So, yeah.
Well, most unique and very beautiful, each one of them.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And then, so we have the Chase Long, and then the William Morris, and then we have this LaBelle chaise.
That's the latest one, yes.
That's the new one, okay.
Yep.
And that's more of a bench thing, yeah.
Yes, yes. And that sort of came about quite organically, because I designed the strip that is the back of that, which is, I guess, a bit like a stretched out diamond. It's got sort of pointy bits at each end and then a panel in the middle. And I designed that maybe thinking that it might go in a bag or something else. And then I thought to myself, gosh, I wonder if this would make another chair. So then it was just a matter of trying to come up with the base. So I haven't even written the pattern for that one yet, because that one's fresh off the frame, really. And normally I don't release a pattern until I've taught it at least once, because that way I can make sure that my instructions are going to be in such a way that anybody can run with it. So people, the best thing about teaching is that people find all your mistakes for you.
Yes.
so and they find the things that, because trying to write the instructions for construction, you've got to try and make it as clear as possible. So I always ask my students to be quite critical of me and make sure that the instructions are as clear as possible. So yeah, that one's not out as a pattern yet.
Well, it's quite beautiful.
And then
beautiful.
Between that, the other one is the Princess, is the Chaise Royale, and that's sort of, I did it in two versions. I did a red version where you only stitch the back and the arms, and the base is actually a velvet. And then there's another version where you stitch the whole thing. And that's the princess version, which is the pink one.
I love that with the rolled armrest.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 That's fun.
Yeah. So you got,
and again, it's quite easy to do, because that's just a rectangle that you turn into a cylinder.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. So from a construction point of view, that's not a tricky thing at all.
Now you've got wood feet on all of these. Are these just beads?
Wooden beads. So anytime I'm in an art supply store, and in fact, when I was teaching in Seattle last year, I'm saying, oh, I need to go to somewhere like Joann's or whatever, just so that I can see different beads, because I'm always on the lookout for wooden beads. So anywhere somewhere you can buy wooden beads that are maybe 12 to 15 mil, so what's that, half to three quarters of an inch, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of size is a nice size for those kinds of chairs. So you can get the very plain spherical ones, but often you can find ones that have got a little bit of detail on them, or they've got a little bit of colour on them, or they've been carved in a particular way, and that can just make for really interesting feet, which then adds to the look of the chair.
Right. Oh, yeah. That puts that little bit of character down at the bottom, yes.
Yeah.
All right. One more, and then we're going to have to wrap this up. Darn it.
Okay.
See, this, well, what that means is you got to come back, so, because there's more to talk about.
I can talk about stitching all day.
So the other one is Dragonflies in the Garden.
Okay, yeah.
What is the ground cloth first?
Okay, so that's on Congress.
Okay.
So I was talking to you before about that silk mesh that lays over the top.
Oh.
So that's got Congress underneath. And then the silk mesh has been applied to the top with Misty Fuse. So Misty Fuse is that lovely, very, very, very fine iron-on fusible. So it's so fine that you don't even have any sensation once you're stitching through it that there's any glue there, if you know what I mean. Have you ever used it? Have you heard of it?
No.
Oh, it's beautiful product, absolutely beautiful product. I heard about it through Jenny Aiden Christie, who's that superb UK embroiderer, and she uses it on some of her very complex layered stuff. And I guess I heard about it from her a few years ago. And then last year I thought, oh, I wonder if you could layer stuff onto the canvas so it looks like it's – so from the top it looks like it's not canvas, but actually you can still do all canvas stitches on it.
Well, and, yeah, it looks like you're stitching on some kind of gold linen or something.
I know. It's pretty cool, right?
So what's the experience then as you're stitching? Because you have the very defined holes of Congress cloth underneath that.
Yeah.
So what's the experience? You kind of
stitch from the back. So it is something where you need to know a little bit about what you're doing. So I wouldn't. It's not a project I'd give to beginners because you need to know what does a Scotch stitch feel like, you know, and what does the progression of stitches look like. So, And so you need to know enough about what you're doing to know what the stitch looks like from the back, because sometimes it's not very easy to see it from the front, depending on how dense the gauze has. So this mesh, when you attach it with a Misty Fuse, because it's so fine and flowing, can move a little bit. So you get almost like a watermark appearance in it. It's really quite beautiful because it won't. I don't ever try and put the grain the same, so I tend to try and put the mesh off grain to the canvas, and then just because it's so light and the Misty Fuse itself is so light, as you iron it, it tends to move a little bit, so you get this movement. So sometimes you'll find there's a little area that might be a little bit more dense, and it can be hard to see the holes of the Congress from the front, so you just need to know where to come up the back. I guess it takes me a little bit longer to stitch those pieces because sometimes I've got to keep turning the frame over and check the back and go back to the front. If you get a bit of light behind it, then you can see the holes more easily. But apart from that, the mesh itself is very forgiving. So I've never had any problems with it looking like it's pulling anything like that. Again, I probably wouldn't do it on 18 count. Because the holes of the 18 count would be too big, and then you really would get that gauze starting to stretch and look a bit messy. But on Congress, or you could put it onto a linen, looks beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can see on this that the Congress mesh is tight enough that it would give a support there. Yes.
Yes, it does. And because it's a silk mesh that's over the top, you've got the sheen of the silk. It's just so much fun.
Well, that's
it really
the, that's
is so
the
much.
Part is the sheen. Yes,
it's just gorgeous. Yeah.
Oh, it's so delicate, and to know now know that there's Congress cloth underneath that is even.
Yeah, so and that silk mesh product is very specifically made by Treetop Colour Harmonies, and she gets it woven for her and then she dyes it herself, and it is a particularly beautiful product, and I know that there are textile artists around the world who use it because it's delicious, you know. It's the kind of thing that you just want to put your hands on and stroke and,
right.
And yeah.
Do you know if it's available in the States?
I would imagine so. If you Google Treetop Colour Harmonies, you'll find it.
Okay.
So she's actually based here in Perth. But she ships around the world and she teaches in all sorts of places around the world. So yeah, it's a well-known product. She actually dyes, wool and silk tops for felting and that sort of stuff. So that's her business and so this silk mesh became a part of that for doing Nuno felting and that sort of thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, folks, pictures. I'll make sure this is one of the pictures on the page for the podcast, and it'll definitely be in the FlossTube video so you can see it. And then is that pattern is not on your Etsy site, or did I miss it?
No, because, again, I haven't even – that one's also fresh off the
– Oh, okay.
Fresh out of the bag. I haven't written the pattern or taught that one yet, but it will. It'll become available. So if within 6 months I haven't taught it, then I tend to go, okay, let's upload this one. So by the end of the year it'll be there.
Okay, so you'll take pre-orders, I'm sure.
I will, absolutely, yes.
Okay.
Of course.
Because I'm pretty confident when people see this, there's...
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's neat. Okay. All right.
All right.
That's it. We got to stop.
We got to stop.
So that means you got to come back, like I said. Yeah. because there's,
I would love to.
There's more to talk about. So, okay. Anne-Marie, thanks so much. Really, really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Yep. And thanks to everybody for listening. I'll be back on Wednesday.